Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is...
Heidi Ashton, and I'm from the Centre for Cultural Media Policy Studies at the University of Warwick, England.
Wow. And of course, this is the place about which E.P. Thompson wrote a book in the early 70s called something like Warwick, comma, Inc. That's
Yes.
Inc. with a C, not a K, because he felt that it had become totally corporate. And it is one
Absolutely,
of the
yeah.
top ranked universities in Britain.
I believe so, yes.
I won't ask you about how appropriate it is to call it Warwick, comma, Inc., but let us say that British universities are trying to sell their wares as much
Yes,
as
but we do have Baroness Ashton as our Chancellor, who is yes, so we're quite an interesting I don't know what you'd call it, paradox maybe.
Any family relationship?
No, sadly, but I could pretend.
I think you should. I
Need to
think
work
we
that
could
angle.
restart this conversation with my saying, and my guest today is, and you can say, my first name is Baroness, but I am known colloquially as Heidi. Anyway, Prof. Ashton, I'd like to begin by asking you if you would share with us what the things are, the thing is, perhaps, currently dynamizing, retarding, propelling, interesting, preoccupying you.
So I noticed that some of your other guests are very good at giving a succinct answers to this. And the truth is that I have a kind of octopus brain, and usually the thing that's most propelling me is whatever I read, heard, saw, observed, experienced in the last 5 minutes. I think intellectually, perhaps, I'm at the moment, I keep coming back to thinking about how did we get here? How did we get to a point in society, and I'm using the UK context predominantly, in which culture and art, which are a foundation of being human, I mean, you can see it in every civilization from the beginning of time, cave paintings, etc. How did we get to a point where that has become so marginalized in our society that it's kind of assumed to be something that's for the elite or the privileged? Or so how on earth did we get from this is the social glue that keeps us all together, to this is something that's peripheral, nice to have? So that's been, I think that's probably the thing that I've been mulling over and working on with a few different things. Yeah.
Now that fascinates me, because there's a rhetoric that we get from a lot of British academics, from British government, and from loveys. You'd better explain what loveys are. That says that the only thing Britain makes that anybody wants, apart from education and bombs, is culture. And this points to popular music, West End shows, the Royal Shakespeare Company, Royal Ballet, Northern Ballet Companies, etc. And we're told that these things are important conceptually, but they're important economically. And so that would suggest that they're not marginal.
Exactly. Yeah. So on the one hand, we have a kind of the rhetoric around, you know, it's our great engine of growth, and it's our, you know, it's our great soft power, etc., etc. But on the other hand, it's had death by a thousand cuts. So there is another rhetoric that underpins it. So for example, in the pandemic, during the pandemic, there was a campaign that went out trying to persuade people from who were doing things like working as a barista in a cafe or working in a warehouse to get training and become cyber experts, cyber security experts. And one of the adverts had a fully trained professional ballet dancer putting on her pointe shoes with a caption that she could be in cyber, she just doesn't know it yet. So on the one hand, they kind of celebrate it as this great export, but on the other hand, it is constantly berated as something that is not, certainly not for the masses. It's not something that you can get a good job, well-paid job. So it's been kind of in various ways. It's been extracted from public state school kind of education. And so because it's seen as not important to get a good job, which they by which they mean a highly paid job. And so everything has become wrapped up in this kind of transactional monetarist ideology, and it's kind of left the arts and culture completely marginalized. So that they celebrate it on the one hand, but they completely marginalize it in every other way. So that's drip fed through various different mechanisms and into the public psyche. And that's quite interesting to me how that's happened, and how that's then come to be sort of just what we know as common sense.
It's interesting you say that. Before Loughborough University got rid of me, amongst many other people, at its satellite campus designed to steal Chinese money that was in East London, I lived in East London. And one of the difficulties that people who were, say, ballet dancers and baristas faced was that Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, which is the taxation entity in Britain, did not regard these people as artists. If they didn't work a certain number of hours per week for gainful as gainful employees in that work. So if you survived by working in a cafe, but your heart and soul and unpaid hours were all in the arts, you were not an artist for the purposes of getting any kind of recognition from the taxation system. This was a very big issue, along with, of course, cyber people moving into East London to the areas that have been abandoned by manufacturing, taken up by artists, but then became cool and safe, and hence too expensive for artists to live in. Same story has happened in Chelsea, in New York City, happening now in Berlin, et cetera, right?
Absolutely, yeah. That's in the other rhetoric around, placemaking and the arts and culture as kind of drivers of change and growth, at the same time as marginalizing the very people that create those environments. So yeah, absolutely. That's a really interesting perspective. Is it similar in Spain?
I know this sounds silly. I've only lived here about a year and a half,
Oh,
so
okay.
I'm not an expert. But the element of culture is so deeply encrusted into everyday life here. And apart from rents, which are not at London levels but are high in the big cities, the cost of living is nugatory. I mean, if you and I went out to have a cup of tea and we stayed and had lunch and then we had some wine, we'd walk out paying 20 euros between us.
Wow.
These are not UK prices, at least not in big cities. And, fruit and vegetables, of course, are all native to here. All the stuff is cheap. It comes from around the corner. It's the same stuff available across seasons. So the cost of living is actually quite minimal here in many, many ways, by contrast with lots of Northern Europe in particular and the global North more generally. So artists can survive despite problems with their policy support and their programmatic support, often because they have this dividend, if you like, of living in a country where so much is cheap. So I think it's not as disastrous here in many ways as it is in Britain. The other element, of course, is that, like Britain, they have the advantage of a very international language. So they're operating in contexts where there are hundreds of millions of Spanish speakers. So a lot of different art that they provide, if it relies on language, can be understood internationally. So they have that sort of bit that can occur. Sometimes, Prof, when I watch British drama on television here, I use the English language subtitles if they don't have Spanish ones, because there are some regional accents that now take me half an hour before I can understand them. Now, Because I grew up in the days when received pronunciation was all you got. You know,
Indeed, yeah.
other than Coronation Street. And I struggle sometimes with knowing what's going on. Here, of course, there are all kinds of accentual differences, as there are across Latin America. But as with English, it's not that hard to cross the divisions. Anyway, long-winded answer. One of the areas where you've done very distinctive and distinguished work, much of it alone, much of it in collaboration with others, is about the precarious nature of cultural work, of cultural labor. And this is a powerful and telling topic. I wonder if you could share with us some of the outcomes, as we're supposed to call them, this work.
Well, I think the outcomes are really more in trying to understand the different ways in which I guess the different social forces, the economic forces, the political forces, and that general rhetoric around whether or not it's a proper job, the ways in which that shapes people's experiences and how we can understand that in order to think about whether or not that's a useful way to move forwards, and whether we can actually sustain a cultural and creative workforce under those conditions. And I think probably the overwhelming finding is absolutely we can't. We certainly can't sustain a diverse workforce by which, and I was listening to your previous guest, is it Georgina?
Georgia Warnke.
Georgia Wonky, yeah. So,
Yeah.
similar kind of issue in terms of when I talk about diversity, I'm more interested in diversity in terms of the inequalities of access and unequal access, regardless of other things that might be part of that access story. But I mean, in terms of socioeconomic group in particular, because that has a particularly powerful impact when people are forced to kind of try and make a living and pay London rents and still be available for work and still do the work.
Yeah.
If you have other resources, regardless of your gender or skin colour, actually, then that becomes much more sustainable and easy. So what happens is we lose the people who have got other stories to tell, who have got other ways of moving, other ways of speaking, other ways of creating art. They're being lost because they can't sustain they can't sustain a living. They can't afford to keep going. So the paying conditions are worsening, and they have been worsening for some time. Although, on a happier note, some of the unions like Equity have had some recent success in the West End with negotiating higher wages. So there are areas where that's coming up, but for the majority of freelance workers, they're being kind of squashed in the middle. So they have employers saying, well, Brexit, the cost of wood is much higher. It's going to cost us more to build a set, so therefore we can no longer pay your expenses, or we'll have to pay you a lower fee than we did last year. And at the same time, all of their costs have gone up. So the cost of living crisis, the cost of heating their apartment or home, their rents, everything is going up. So they're kind of they're getting less and paying out more. And it means that they're paying to work, and some people are having to leave the industry. And coupled with that, we have a welfare system now that has become less about welfare and again is very, very transactional. So it's a matter of you having to demonstrate how you can be value for taxpayers' money if you are receiving income support of any kind, or universal credit, as it's now known. And they have a year on this system. And if they don't, after that year, if they need more money, they can't get it. I mean, they literally, it's called the minimum income floor. If they don't earn the equivalent of the minimum wage, then they lose all their benefits. So they don't have any money for housing. People have been made homeless. I mean, it's quite shocking and stark to see how that system that's supposed to be a safety net for people has been kind of eroded, and that this constant what happens is every time you kind of enter into a dialogue with at policy level, what comes back is it's not good value for taxpayers. It's not, it has to be, you have to show it, you have to justify any kind of public funding in terms of its perceived value to taxpayers. And I say perceived because it's the value given by one or two people at the top. It's not, this isn't a real kind of value. And can you put a value on a quality of life? I mean, how does that work? So, and what quality of life would we have if we didn't have any art or culture? So that's the problem that these workers are facing, and it's an unregulated market. They don't actually exist in policy, so there's no such thing as a freelancer. You're either employed or self-employed, but they are reliant on employers to employ them, whilst at the same time, you know, being having to look for that work constantly. So their precarity is gaining, their earnings are dropping. And some of them are literally just kind of having to leave and work somewhere else or do something else. So we're losing people from our creative and cultural labour market, and I think that's definitely not a good thing, and we need to work out how to put it right.
What did you do to learn about these folks and their situation in your research? How did you go about it?
So there's different methodologies. One of them is an ethnography, because I'm embedded, having had a previous life. Well, actually, it's not, I'm lying, it's not previous. It's still going on. I'm co-producing a show now. But my other world, my other life, where I was a dancer, choreographer, and produced shows. So I'm kind of embedded in that world, which is an interesting place to be in research-wise. Philosophically, in terms of how you manage that kind of insider perspective against a bias. So I take notes as an ethnographer, and I interview people. I look at surveys, I look at a lot of documents, policy documents. I research, desk-based research, so I look at what other empirical research has been done, what other kind of theoretical research has been done around the area. And I try and use those things to understand whatever the research question is that I'm grappling with at the time.
And forgetting Warwick Inc. for a moment, the university has been renowned for its work on cultural policy for a very long time. It's a very distinguished place for that, as it used to be, probably still is, for labour history, thanks to E.P. Thompson, we mentioned earlier. It's the centenary of his birth was a few weeks ago, actually. And yeah, I wonder whether the university celebrated this. Who knows? But in any event, it is terrific that your work is being done there, because this is one of the places to be read, I think, when it comes to that sort of topic, and one of the places to study as well. But it does sound as though the situation, ethnographically, anecdotally, empirically, in inverted commas, is dire. And I wonder if we could juxtapose that with that word I used earlier, lovies, because I think the concept of the lovey assumes ineffably middle class, if not a ruling class fraction, doesn't it? I mean, that's, how is that word used in Britain? Because it is a really interesting one in these debates. It shadows a lot of discussion about the arts, I think.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. So a lovey is a is somebody in the kind of theatrical world, usually a performer, and it could be a singer, dancer. Actually, musicians can be loveys as well, although they probably would hate me for saying that. So it is, I think, so when I was doing some research on the career transitions of freelance dancers, they have a very short, finite career. Generally by their early 30s, that, like any athlete, really, they are forced to leave that, you know, your bodies can only take that abuse for so long, and then you have to find your way out. And in looking at how they find their way out, what was very stark is that they create very strong communities. And the reason that they create these very strong communities is because they're kind of othered, in a kind of Beckerian sense, from an early age, and especially dancers, they start very young, so they're constantly kind of the people who they relate to most are the people that have the same passion, and that's often very different from their school experience, and that can happen with musicians as well and actors. So they also work at a different time of day to everybody else. So they're working in the evenings and weekends. So they're missing out on lots of family events, or and the work comes first. There is no kind of distinction between work and life. So these are the things that these kind of what I'm going to call cultural workers, for want of having a long debate about the difference between culture and creativity. And the creative industries, these are people who kind of then come together as we understand our world, but our world isn't very well understood. And this starts right from careers. So people will talk about how they would say to a careers officer, "I'm going to be a dancer or a musician," and they say, "Well, yeah, you have to have a job. Like, what are you going to do? That's a lovely hobby, but what are you going to do for a job?" And so there's this kind of sense that people don't really understand what it entails, the kind of work and the time and the effort and the passion that goes into developing and creating this work and becoming a cultural worker. And a kind of, I think partly because the idea is to make it look easy, like anybody can do it. It has to look effortless. And in doing so, people don't think it's very serious or don't think it's very challenging. Certainly, a dancer can't show the physical hardship and the pain that they're going through in the same way that an athlete might. You know, if they're starting groaning like a tennis player every time they did a lever, it would spoil the illusion and the story. And so these things I think tend to mean that people outside, because the whole point of the magic of the theatre or the magic of screen is that you don't show the workings, like you don't show the hard work behind it, and so you can't blame people then for not understanding that's what's there. But it creates a kind of sense of being othered, and if you other any group, as kind of Becca talks about in Outsiders, they tend to coalesce in their own community and their own culture, really. So I think love is a term of endearment within it, but it has been used as a derogatory term outside. But similarly, people in the industry might talk people outside as muggles.
As what?
Muggles, that's a recent thing.
Muggles.
It used to be normal, so now it's muggles.
Normals.
So it's not actually meant disrespectfully. It's just a
It
way
doesn't sound
to.
like it.
I know, it really
Hello.
does.
What's your name? Oh, it doesn't matter. I'm a muggle.
I'm a muggle.
And what about you? Well, I'd like to be a lovey, but I think I'm a
Now I'm a
luggy.
muggle.
I may be a lugly. I'm not sure.
I started off as a lovey and I ended up as a muggle, so there we are.
I wonder what the etymology of this word is. Muggle.
Muggle, oh, it's from Harry Potter.
Oh, okay.
It's a cultural reference to Harry Potter, where the magic people are the magic people, and then you have the muggles.
Got it. Okay, charming. It does sound a little
Yeah.
derogatory, if I may say so. However,
Yeah.
so.
It's not intended that way. It's just an example of how they kind of have to feel that they have to kind of create their own community because they're not understood. There's not much kind of communication across, and often don't feel as though it's a respected profession or a serious profession
Yeah.
or a profession even.
I wonder if we could speak about injuries a bit, Prof H, because this is something that is getting more and more attention in sports. For example, the amount of anterior cruciate ligament injury sustained by women footballers has become a big issue. The cerebral injuries sustained by mostly male pro footballers because they've been doing it for longer and so on. And of course, as you say, per dance, it's a short career in sports because your body gives out. For our, in inverted commas, entertainment, we are destroying young bodies, aren't we?
I mean, pretty much. It's difficult to argue with that point. I mean, there's a lot of there's been a lot of research, and there's a lot more understanding now about how to care for your body and make sure that it lasts. That's all pushed obviously onto the individual. I think if you're in a big company like the Royal Ballet, for example, then there's physios on tap. You have training every day. You have people, specialists that you can go to. If you are a freelancer, which are the people that I work with, you want to go to class, you have to pay for that. Like if you have an injury, you can go to the GP, but they probably won't be able to help you. And so you're probably going to have to pay for a specialist physio. And then you may have to pay for if it is a cruciate ligament, which is a reasonably common injury, then quite often people have to pay for that themselves. So it becomes another layer actually in the dance profession. But it is self-inflicted, and weirdly, we like the pain. Don't ask me. It's very strange, and sounds a little bit worrying. But it's you can have a good pain and a bad pain, so they're
I'm used to these
distinctive.
concepts. I'm used to these concepts. What about questions of the nature of the body? So I've had friends who were dancers in inverted commas, but grew too tall. And I've often asked them, what does that mean, actually? I'm talking about women here. I haven't known men who became dancers, but I've known women who became dancers or were set to become dancers. One very short. Her problem was she lost all feeling in her feet at 18, all feeling, and thought perhaps I should stop now. And the other person I knew grew too tall, by which I mean a woman of maybe 173 or 4 centimeters. So could you tell us a little bit about the kind of body that's acceptable for different genders in dance?
Yeah, that's another thing that has evolved over time, but it's also it depends on the genre of dance and where you're doing it. So the aesthetic labor involved, though, is huge. I mean, if anybody wants to study aesthetic labor, dancers are a kind of probably a limit case almost. So I think lots of people have looked at models and things, but dancers are really kind of under scrutiny. Many of the dancers that I spoke to over the years and been in contact with, and I've been exposed to it myself, have been told to lose weight, have been told that you're the wrong size, you're the wrong height. You can get a job or not based on your height, or your hair color, or your size, or the proportions of your body. So at the Royal Ballet, they used to, I don't know if they still do it, I imagine they probably still do, have re specific ratios. So your body has to grow in particular ratios, like your body length to your leg length. And if you outgrow that ratio, then you are no longer deemed suitable for classical ballet in the school. So classical ballet has its own kind of aesthetic, but then if you think of street dancers, they tend to be of a different aesthetic and more muscular as a stereotype, although it's a little bit more of an open space, is a bit more of a forgiving space. There has been a lot of I think there has been an effort to try to prevent the levels of things like anorexia and bulimia, which did proliferate and still are problematic, particularly in the classical world. But contemporary and street and kind of what we would call commercial dance, which is your general backing dancer that you see on a pop concert or in a West End show, or there has been a kind of a move towards accepting different body shapes and aesthetics, and allowing people's talent and hard work to be the thing that drives. But sometimes it will be a matter of you're taking over somebody else's role. You have to fit the costume. That's it.
I'm
That's the
sorry,
criteria.
I want the Royal Ballet taken to court for saying you have grown in this direction. Fuck off. I mean, I'm sorry, I find that absolutely appalling. And I don't think of classical music, opera, ballet patrons as necessarily insisting on one stereotype, or does everyone have to be Margot Fonteyn? Have I got that wrong? Do they love this notion of the tiny woman?
Yeah, I think it's partly actually it's in the training. So I will give them that the training trains your muscles into a particular aesthetic. So if we think of sprint runners versus long distance runners, the guys tend to be more sprint looking because they have a lot of very explosive movements, very high jumps, and that's in their training, whereas the women tend to be more lean and are more kind of built for just keeping going and holding themselves up and things. So there is part of the aesthetic is built into the training, but there is certainly, I mean, funnily enough, it was New York City Ballet that slightly changed the aesthetic. So they went for a taller dancer, and prior to that, British ballet dancers were tended to be a bit shorter. Margot Fonteyn wasn't particularly tall, but then we had like Darcy Bustle and Sylvie Guillem. But that was a kind of a preference that came over from some of the choreographers from New York. So it sometimes it's about the choreographer and their preference and how that feeds into the ways in which the stories are told, or the people that get to have those particular parts, and then that drip feeds down into these are the people that will be right for this genre. And it has been problematic, as I said, but it's partly embedded in the training, and it's a kind of combination of things. But absolutely, it's wrong to just that. But that's the truth of being a dancer. You will be fired if you put on too much weight, or you won't get a job in the first place.
And of course, this applies, as you say, in the more popular arts to a certain extent. Think of a tradition of Busby Berkeley dancing girls who all looked exactly the same.
Yeah, and the
And that is
Rockettes.
still favored, although with things like backing singers, you do get much more variety in the look of people, I think, and many musicians, actually, some dancers in the so-called popular arts. But I appreciate that. I'm sorry for my attack on the Royal Ballet, but I am shocked they can get away with that because it's something that airlines used to do to their female employees, and I think some still do, but was quickly in the by the 70s was illegal in most English-speaking countries because it was clearly discriminatory. At the same moment when women were allowed to be married and keep their jobs, all kinds of.
I think it was an eye-opener to me that the rest of the world didn't behave like that when I first left dance.
This is the moment where I'm wanting to draw you into your own experience, only to the level that you're comfortable with disclosing, of course. Tell us about where dance came from for you. Did you grow up with that as a family tradition or heritage? Or was it something you saw on the telly and liked, something at school?
It was actually, I mean, if I had to pinpoint it's which is difficult, I would say that a kind of key moment maybe was going to see the local pantomime. So for the non-English audience out there, it's a very peculiar British tradition of of theatre, but it's very participatory. It's ahead of its time in many ways. And it's for children, and they tell a story, and it's the audience get involved in it, and they always have local children
He's
playing
behind you.
the
He's behind you.
flute. Oh
Oh,
no, he isn't. And I saw these children on stage looking like they were having a great time. And I thought, that looks really fun. I would love to do that. And my mum said, no, I can't afford all the gear. Like, I'll have to buy you a leotard and shoes, and it costs a lot of money. Go and learn to swim and do something else. The school pays for that. Off you go. So yeah, it took about a year of pestering. I think the final point was the local amateur dramatic society were auditioning children, and I didn't get in because all the children went to the local dance school and they knew how to polka and I didn't, and I cried. And so at age 9, my mum relented, and I was very fortunate to go to A, have very supportive parents, and B, have a fantastic school, that shout out to June Denny School of Dance, who they were fantastic teachers, and it's so key to have good training at that age, and it was just luck. It was just that they were my local dance school, and they also gave me opportunities that they used to let, because I was late starting, I didn't start till I was 9. They used to let me join in the next class up for free and things like that, so that I could progress and that it wasn't too much of a financial drain for the family. And then went on to train professionally with what we had in the old days, which is a grant, which you don't have anymore. So yeah, so I was fortunate in the time that I was training, but that was my inspiration was pantomime.
And which part of the country did you train in?
It's a small town in the east coast called Lowestoft. It's also known derogatory as the wart on the arse of Britain. So
I didn't know that, but nice. Love it. I was born in a city that for many years was voted most boring city in Europe, although it became the first majority minority city in Europe.
not Leicester.
Yeah.
That's where I was born.
You're kidding.
No, I was born in Leicester till I was 6. Then we moved to Lowestoft, and then I went back to Leicester to work at the university
I
and
saw
with the Centre
that.
for Labour Market Studies.
Yes. Well, it is a pretty boring place despite being so multicultural, I have to say. Although I regard myself as a true son of Leicester. And one of the great
Excellent.
things about living for decades in the Americas and now in Spain is explaining to people how to say the
That's part of its charm. Whereabouts in Leicester were you? Sorry, I've
Well,
digressed.
born in what was called Leicester General Hospital, which probably became Royal something or other later. And where did we live? I mean, we lived in one of those streets that was middle class and now has sort of exclusive Islamic girls' schools and things like that in it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so Stoughton Drive North, that sort
Oh,
of.
Stoughton Drive. Yeah, I
Yeah.
know it. And so how did you end up? Did you go to university at Leicester?
No, my father was a migrant to Britain, and he and my mother and I m moved around a lot. So we went to India and then back to Leicester and then to New York and then back to Leicester and then to Australia and then where he was from. And then we moved every 3 years, we came back to Britain, but by that stage they were into the smoke, and so we lived in London. So
Wow.
I grew up more in what was in those days mixed class Fulham, Chiswick area, but now, of course, is completely Hooray Henry style BMWs in every driveway, etc. But it was very different in those days.
Well, that's fascinating.
So
Well, it must have been an interesting upbringing to have all those different cultural interests influences.
It was. Anyway, so
Right.
unfortunately, I can't get to talk all the time about myself, much as I would love to. So you go to this dancing school in Lowestoft, but you don't go straight from there to Leicester University to work in a research center. What happens to you next? You've got your, young Prof H has her grant in her hand.
I went to a college, performing arts college called Lane Theatre Arts. I had got into one of the kind of higher end ballet schools, but I didn't have the body. Well, they I didn't have the turnout, and I didn't have the so there were particular physical attributes that I didn't have, that they said, well, you could make it as one of the kind of top four, but you could never be like a soloist ballet dancer in a company. And so I was much better anyway at jazz and contemporary, and so I decided to go
Yeah,
to a college that.
sorry, what does turnout mean? I don't
Oh,
know.
sorry,
No.
it's I'll show you, like, it's where you put your foot that way instead of that way.
Oh, turnout of the
Turn
foot.
out, so your feet would normally be in parallel like this, and it's where you go like that with your feet, and that's the first position. So
The first
that's the
position.
turnout.
Oh, yes,
Yes,
I can do the first
first position.
position. But what
Yeah,
your the angle of your feet wasn't wide enough when you took the
it's the
first
way
position.
your hips are in your hip socket, because the turnout should actually come from the hip, not from the foot. So the whole leg should rotate outwards. So the knees are facing out to the sides and
Got
not facing forwards.
it. I'm just going to try this. See. Oh my God. Well,
That's it. Yeah.
thank you, but it hurt my hips. I don't like it. I think my version of the first position is infinitely superior in terms of this particular body at this age. But anyway, oh,
Well,
interesting. So
so some
literally,
people,
it's just the angle of the hips that can decide, along
yeah.
with other factors like height and body shape and gender and
But
so on.
yeah, the arch of your foot as well. Yeah. There's a whole world of anatomy in there
Yeah,
that, yeah,
yeah.
that can mean that you're not quite right. So yeah, so because
Lots
it
of
was,
assumptions here about femininity, I would say. Yeah or no?
yes, I think there are, but they're usually different or tangentially the same to other aesthetics or other general aesthetics. So things like turnout, actually the amount of turnout in your hips, it's something that you are kind of born with, really. It's something you can improve, but only to a degree, and it would be the same for men and women.
Okay.
The
So
feet,
inside that.
again, more women but men as well to some extent. If you've got a really high arch, better for you.
So in terms of these native physical attributes, but which one can do very little, you decide that you'll move into what is a more open sphere in terms of
Yeah.
body shape and type and so on, which is jazz, yeah, and
Yeah.
modern.
Yeah. And musical theatre. I mean, it was a college that specialised in dance within a kind of musical theatre context, because musical theatre, you could end up doing classical ballet and point work. You could end up doing Bob Fosse style jazz. You could end up doing more street styles. You could end up with a contemporary style. So you have to learn all the genres and be competent enough in all the genres to be able to go to an audition. And an audition is quite a brutal place where hundreds of you go in, and you go in groups sometimes, sometimes not. You learn a sequence by watching somebody do it, and then in smaller groups you perform that sequence immediately. So you have to learn it, perfect it, memorize it, perform it as if it's in a full performance mode, and then they will cut you down. So they'll say you, and you, and then the rest can leave. And then if you get selected, you come back and you go through the whole process again. So you have to be proficient enough at every genre, and tap dancing and all those things. So we trained in all the different genres, and then we also had singing and acting classes.
Wow. And after that,
It was like the Fame School. Like, that
I was
was,
going to say clearly,
yeah.
after that, what happened?
So after that, I went into the world of work. So aged 19 with just GCSEs and no A levels, I went into I started working. I think I worked in Birmingham, was my first job, opening the National Indoor Arena with AIDA, the opera, and then I went onto a cruise ship. So it was very eclectic mix of work, because
Yeah.
you have to go where the work is. You have to
Go where the work
audition.
is.
If you get the job, you take it. So I was very lucky. I worked in all different kind of capacities, like contemporary company, ballet company, lots of different versions of jazz, musical theatre, TV, film. Not not, it's, I'm making it sound really glamorous and easy, and it was. And there were a lot of the times I was out of work and doing all kinds of ridiculous jobs to try and pay my rent and just make ends meet. So yeah, it wasn't easy, and the lows are low, but the highs are high. So you kind of go with it. And then I kind of, as I was going through, I sort of was worried that I was going to get to the end and everybody else would have a degree and I didn't even have an A level.
And
So,
A-level, just to explain for
oh,
the
sorry, yes.
listeners, so when Prof H says she left with GCSEs, these are public exams that people take when they're 15, 16. And then, depending on their results and their desires, they go on to take what are called A-levels. When I was at school, these were called variously O-levels and A-levels. And O was ordinary and A was advanced. But of course, you cannot be truthful about what these things actually are. So they get acronyms that change or overtake their actual signifieds, and the A level is the route to university. So just to go back, so you suddenly thought,
Yeah.
oh, good grief, what's going to happen to me when I'm 30 or 35 or something?
Yeah. So and it's an incredibly painful thing to think of leaving the profession, because it's you only do it if you've really got a passion for it, because it's hard when you haven't got work, it's really hard. And when you're going to lots of auditions and being told we don't want you. It's impossible not to take it personally, because you're standing there in front of them and you're performing for them and you're sweating and pleading for them, and they say no, next, no thank you. You kind of really have to have a passion for it to stick it out. But I enrolled with the Open University, and you could do a foundation course. So the Open University is a distance learning university in the UK. And it's a wonderful institution. I have a huge amount of respect for the Open University, because it gave me the opportunity to have another career as an academic. And without it, I there's no way I could have done it. I couldn't afford to just stop dancing and, go and take some A levels and try and get into a university. It just wasn't something that was possible for me. So luckily, I had access to the Open University, and I just went through. I mean, and it's part time, so it took me 6 years, but I eventually got my degree in psychology. And then I did another distance learning degree course with Birkbeck, which is another wonderful institution that supports people who haven't had other opportunities. I got my master's in organizational behavior occupational psychology, which I wanted to do sports psychology, but you couldn't do it as distance learning. And then I've done all kinds of, I'm an opportunist. So I kind of did a bit of sports psych for British diving, sports psychology, that is. I've done, I still work as a kind of co-producer. I've got a show going on the road. I've been involved in choreographing and assisting on TV and film throughout, while I was kind of getting these, and then beyond. So I went to do my PhD at the University of Leicester at the Centre for Labour Market Studies, and I've just managed to kind of keep. I can't leave it. That's the problem. I
So
can't.
you're still doing choreography
Yeah, a
and
bit.
producing.
Yes, a bit. I mean, yeah, that's because that's quite a tight squeeze. That's basically two full-time jobs. But it's not paid, because we couldn't get funding. The funding for the arts in the UK has been slashed to nothing. I mean, it's really, really difficult now to get funding. So I was passionate about this project and I really wanted it to happen. So yes, I'm co-producing on that at the moment. So I've worked that alongside building up an academic career.
So, a couple of quick things, Prof. I'd like to ask you two more questions before we conclude, and after my questions, throw to you to add anything you might want. The first is to ask about the show that you're co-producing.
Oh, I thank you for the plug. It's a production and by a new dance company called KVN Dance Company, and it's a complete reworking of the original ballet of Coppelia. So He was very the creative director and choreographer is fantastic. His name's Kevin Allen. I've worked with him a lot over the years. And he has a very different way of approaching storytelling and dance. Having also come from this eclectic world of having to learn lots of genres, he uses different genres and different dance movements and styles to tell different parts of the story. So it isn't genre-based production. It merges and it uses the movement that's right to tell that part of the story or to for that character in the story. So and alongside that, Richard Berg is our amazing composer, and he's reworked the score and kind of put these electronic sounds and accompaniments in and changed some of it and written some new stuff for it. So it's what we'd like to do is we'd like for all different dance audiences to come together and be feel that they it's something that they can enjoy and experience a different genre that they might not normally be attracted to, but also to be relatable to a whole wide range of audiences because dance is so I mean, it's fundamental. We all move. So that's what we're doing. We're touring the UK at the moment with our production of Coppelia. Well, we will be. We start rehearsals next week.
Oh, wow. Oh, so it's all on.
Yes.
All on, heavens. And so as a co-producer, do you travel with the show? Or no.
I will be to some extent, to the extent that it doesn't interfere with the work that I need to do at university as well. Because, yeah, well, I still have to pay the bills. I'm still living that life.
And
But actually, I love working at the university, so I should say that I've had a lot of opportunity to do the research and to, really have the opportunity to think about things on different levels and from different perspectives. I'm given the opportunity to teach and develop my teaching. So it is somewhere that is very supportive and I enjoy that. So it's important to me to still contribute.
And do your old friends from the Love Boat think that you've become very fancy now that you've got a PhD?
Nobody cares. No, PhD, I didn't actually know what PhD was until I got, kind of well into my master's degree because I didn't even go to a normal university. I studied by myself in rehearsal studios and things. So yeah, PhD is meaningless to most of us.
You know, Silvio Berlusconi, who was Prime Minister of Italy and, of course, major media guy, he was a singer on Love Boats.
Oh, was
He
he?
was a crooner, yeah. And
Well,
apparently very good. That's how he got his start.
Betty Boothroyd was a Tiller girl.
Was she?
Yes.
This is a now deceased, I think, first
Yes.
female Speaker of the House of Commons, I think.
Absolutely, yes. An
Yeah.
amazing one. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. And I loved her thing about how, when asked why she'd never married, she had some fantastic answer like, well, no one was good enough, something like
Brilliant. She was
that.
also the Chancellor of the Open University.
Oh, of course,
Brilliant.
indeed she was.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Yes, a formidable figure, deeply impressive.
Yeah.
Deeply
So,
impressive.
us dancers, you never know.
No. Wow. You must tell us what a telegirl is.
Oh, sorry, a Tiller girl. For the American audiences, they will recognize it as rockettes. It's that kind of style of dance that was around, gosh, what was the era that the Tiller Girls, was it probably the 40s?
40s, yeah.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. I did a piece on the kind of the intensity of work in the sector and looking at kind of Adorno's Adorno was very scathing of this type of entertainment because it's he said that it replicated that the dancers when they or as Verno actually I think when they dance because they're very much in sync they're like a machine so the factory workers would go and it just reinforces a kind of capitalist ideology but when you look at the interviews with these people they were like well my choices were go and work in a factory or I could be this dancer and I could travel. And it was kind of, I had these opportunities and I could go on a stage. And so we kind of looked at those different kind of perspectives of work and work and cultural sector and what it means in different places and different spaces and in different ways. So yeah, so the Tillagaal is a popular culture style of professional dance.
And so my last question, I threw in the Telugu ones because I thought people should know, is what next for you?
Oh, good question. So right now with the tour, obviously, work what I'm working on at the moment is I'm going to take a deep breath because if I say it out loud, I'm really going to have to do it. So I'm working on co-authoring a book that is about this how did we get here question. Like what happened, and we're tracing the different ways in which the kind of monetarist ideology. So, for full disclosure, this is with my dad, who is a sociologist, who was at Leicester for many years, but not when I was there. And we were interested because we started talking and we realised that I've been brought up in a kind of from the Thatcher era, so everything goes back to money. Like, it doesn't matter how you think about something, it goes back to money. And it was quite interesting talking to him because he come from a more Keynesian era of economics where, you know, there was a social good. Actually, the role of the state is for the health of society, and the economy is part of that, but it's not the thing. And so that shift from how we used to think about foregrounding the health of the society and the health of the people within a society to foregrounding the economy as money and everything relating back to you are only worth what your value is in the marketplace. You are, you know, that kind of shift, how that shift has happened through different ways and different policies and different rhetoric over time. And over different governments, as it's the same through the Blair government, you know, it didn't change. That was the Labour government that we had in the interim between two Conservatives, really. So we're looking at how did that happen? And if it happened before, we can shift it again. But what would it look like to shift it again? So if we're looking at kind of degrowth kind of concepts and like Benanav's kind of ideas of how what a future might look like. Quite often, those futures actually don't include arts and culture, interestingly, because everyone will have time to do arts and culture, so we won't need it. It's still kind of locked into it's an industry. Whereas Justin O'Connor's new book, to give him a quick plug because it's a fantastic book, Culture is Not an Industry. He kind of talks about it as the social glue, and we're kind of thinking about, well, how can we go back to that? How can we find our way to rethink the way that we think about the role of the state and how societies and economies work, in that is more that's more appropriate for this age, that is going to actually try and deal with some of the inequalities and the problems with the climate change and all of these kind of issues that we're facing now. We know that the current ideology is not working. We know that it's reached its end, and it's really encouraging to hear that coming through in different literature, and it's making its way into policy. When I say different literature, I mean economists are talking about it, sociologists are talking about different areas, different people coming together and saying similar things. So there's that bubbling under the surface. So by tracing the history of how we got here, we're hoping to find ways of thinking about how we move on in a positive way, and also looking at other cultures, the way that other countries have dealt with it. So, you know, Singapore and other European countries where that's culture and arts are still embedded in it, and the importance of a healthy society is still an important function of the state. So that's one thing. I'm also writing a book I won't go on about so much. Sorry. About dance and dance work, but what it can tell us, what that kind of biographical approach to understanding workers and work from beginning to end can tell us about other parts of our of the la different labour market issues, the things like aesthetic labour, different things that kind of come up through looking at that journey. Things like the deregulation of labour markets, those sort of thing, what that then, how that results, because we know that it's happening in other sectors. And I've got a couple of things coming out around the welfare state and cultural and creative workers, and another one about bullying and harassment and cultural and creative work. So they're the things that I'm working on at the moment. But what about you? I want to know what you're working on.
That's exciting. That's really exciting.
I don't
My
know,
dad
it's a
was a
lot.
professor at Leicester as well.
Oh, really? In which department?
Politics, but would have been long before your dad was there. Long
Well,
before.
you never know, there might have been crossover. So my dad was in sociology with Norbert Elias.
He was one of my father's, I think, colleagues and opponents, really, for whatever reason. But
Fascinating.
yes, of course, the Elias tradition is tremendously important in sociology. Sadly, not as important as it should be in the US, which numerically is the home of sociology in terms of the number of ologists running around. But everywhere else, he's a huge name, and rightly so. Rightly so. What am I working on? Well, I have a book coming out in about a week called Why Journalism. And other than that, I'm trying to write something about James Bond and snobbery.
Oh, excellent. Now that there's lots of feminist takes in there as well.
Well, I discovered that Virginia Woolf wrote a long essay about herself as a snob.
Oh, really?
Yes, and it is full of anecdotes about when she was in the Bloomsbury set, instead of seeing herself as the centre of attraction, as we would, or one of the centres of attraction, along with Keynes and Morell and all those families and the Strachey's, she wanted to sit next to famous male novelists at dinners. So, how can I sit next to Mr. Wells? How can I meet Arnold Bennett? How can I? It's very self-critical and very funny. Very, very funny.
I really
I'm
admire
trying
people with
to,
that
so
wit.
I'm trying to work out what snobbery is, because it turns out Thackeray sort of coined the term, and in those days it meant the opposite of what it means today. So I'm interested in how that happens and what the differences are between snobbery in 007 in the fiction and on screen. And of
Oh,
course, issues to do
interesting.
with imperialism and misogyny and
Yeah.
all those other things. And I'm trying to get together the wherewithal. I don't have employment after the end of August to write a book called Inventing People, which is going to be about how people are made up, drawing for its inspiration in part on Ian Hacking's ideas about making up people, but with reference to genetic interventions in utero, touching on
Wow.
what you were explaining to me earlier.
Yeah.
How do you make a rotator cuff in utero that means that somebody can be a great baseball pitcher? How do you make sure that somebody won't be a Catholic? And on it goes, right? But also issues to do with trans people and trans sports. What counts as a woman, what counts as a man, how these things are decided legally, philosophically, medically, the kinds of intervention that occur. So that's what I'm trying to do. And I'm trying
That's a lot.
to, yes, well, it is, but I'm really trying to get a job.
Well, come and work with us. I'm sure. It would be lovely actually to have you come and give a talk about your book. I mean the journalism book. I mean journalism is a really fascinating area because of the kind of deprofessionalization and then the kind of the journalism and the those kind of other things that have come out of the moving into kind of social media and the changing nature of the role. And actually they've had a fragmented labor market. They used to have full time. You kind of became a journalist was a huge thing, right? And there was ethics that came with that, and how that's been kind of eroded in, and everyone's now a freelancer and trying to hustle for gigs. in the freelance world. So what's your book about in that respect?
It's about, in part, the philosophy of journalism, what it's supposed to do. And I'm interested in what lots of stale, pale males like me have said historically. So everybody from Kant through to Lenin, that's V.I. Lenin, also centenary, this time of his death rather than birth, but also Rosa Luxemburg, Ida B. Wells, and other important figures. Hegel was really interesting about this. He was a freelance journalist. He was able to write his philosophy, depending on the version of his life that you accept, either as a full-time editor or alternatively, as a guy who wrote like sports reports on boar hunts.
Really?
Yeah. So I'm interested in these dudes and what they say journalism is for, and how that then gets taken up by people whom your dad would have had to teach, like Tönnies and Weber in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, as well as practitioners like Ida B. Wells, or for that matter, Lenin. And then it looks at particular genres of coverage and what's happened to them. So, sports, because this is one where artificial intelligence has been used in journalism for 15 years
Oh,
by
really?
companies like Yahoo. Yeah, nothing new about it. It's just that it's having a bigger influence elsewhere. Democracy, and specifically the reportage of wars and the reportage of questions of speech. So I look at the Charlie Hebdo massacre in Paris, and associated issues in terms of what the limits are in different cultures, different places, different points in history, what you can say and who can say it, who authorizes it. And a chapter on the environment, which is both about the nature of environmental coverage by journalists and what it should be, what it could be, and also an account of the damage that journalists do, not only through misreporting the science, but also through their own use of digital technology. And then a chapter on technology and its history in journalism. So basically, when the book comes out on March 24th, tell your parents and friends, take their money out of the banks, put it under the bed, because a feminist socialist decolonial revolution will be happening. It will be entirely peaceful. No one will get hurt, but your money may not be safe. That's all I'm saying.
Well, it would be wonderful if you are coming over to the UK, please let me know because we would love to host you at Warwick and it would be fantastic to have you come and give a guest lecture or guest seminar across our school and our faculty. I'm sure everybody would really enjoy learning from your wisdom. So please do keep in touch.
Well, listen, Prof, thank you very, very much. That was great. And especially saying nice things to me and asking me about me. I love that part. No,
Oh, I'm in awe, really.
but it was wonderful chatting to you. And now that I'm going to be obsessed with the turnout, which for me has always meant something cephalogical, how many people vote. But now I know it's actually the first position. And what I thought was the first position was not really that. So thank you very much.
Well, lovely treat. Thank you so much. Thank you for the opportunity. It's been wonderful talking to you. I don't feel like I've really imparted anything interesting, but I'm
Well,
sure you'll do some magic.
turnout and the Love Boat were incredible gifts to all of us in and of themselves. Thank you, Professor.
Oh, take care. Bye-bye.